Hello, everyone, and welcome to Behind the Bar Show. I'm your host, Tim Morrison, aka Mr. Martini. This is a special episode, and we'll be interviewing B. Alex, distiller of Upsello Absinthe. During a break, we'll have an absinthe quote, of course. So kick back with an absinthe drip and enjoy the show. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Behind the Bar Show's 54th episode. I'm sitting here with my glass of absinthe and just celebrating the interview that I just recently did and recording this show. So what is this show about? Absinthe, of course. But Tim, you say, you already did an absinthe episode. Well, yes, I did an episode 9, which was posted back in March 2006. But things have changed since then. Most importantly, absinthe is legally being sold in the U.S. That alone should be plenty of reason to do another absinthe episode. But I'm also happy to announce that this episode has a guest. B. Alex is the distiller of Esmeralda Distillery, who makes Upsello Absinthe, a Spanish absinthe that is made in the traditional way. Before we get to that interview, I only have one listener feedback I want to go over. Hello, Peter of the East Coast Booze Brothers in Raleigh, North Carolina. I am humbled and honored by your email, and I must share it for everyone else. Peter wrote, "Dear Mr. Martini, I have recently started listening to your podcast, and I'm very impressed. I've only been listening for a week, but I'm already at episode 25. I can't get enough. My name is Peter, and I've been a flair bartending mixologist for over 12 years in Raleigh, North Carolina, at a dozen of bars and restaurants. Currently, I'm bartending manager at Glenwood Grill and flair bartending at the Black Flower. I've also been searching for more info on drinks and experimenting behind the bar. Your show has really opened my eyes to many drinks that I'd never thought about making. I'm mixing so many new cocktails at both bars, and my patrons and I would all like to thank you and wish you the best with Behind the Bar. One last thing, have you done a show on foams?" Well, thank you very much, Peter, for that email. Keep up the great work yourself, and thank you for recommending a show on foams. I'll most likely stretch that out to do a show on molecular mixology, which will definitely include foams. If any of you are out there in Raleigh, North Carolina, head on over to Black Flower and check out Peter Behind the Bar. Just be sure to give him a good tip. Now, let me give a big hello to everyone who has joined my Facebook page. Hello, Nelson, Jennifer, Marsha, Mike from Michigan, Michael from Seattle, my man Marinos in Greece, Steve and Leah here in my neck of the woods, Chris in the U.S. Air Force, thank you for your service. Hello, Sunshine Tiki from Zen Tiki Lounge, Josh from Illinois, my dear friend Chris, who actually talked me into doing this podcast, Taisha in D.C., what an adorable baby picture, by the way, Kat in Tennessee, Jamie in Columbus, Ohio, Jessica in the East Bay, my dear friend and fellow podcaster, Sandy Shepard from Be a Bond Girl, Anthony Caparelli from Art of the Drink, hello David in Massachusetts, of course, you know, gotta say hello to the guys who recorded the spoof of my show, which was on episode 53, Stefan and Robert in Frankfurt, Germany. Hello, Chris in Denmark and creator of BrilliantCocktails.com. What's up, Ian in Delaware and Katie in the East Bay. Then there's Joseph in New Jersey, Dustin and Matt in Florida, Karen in Massachusetts, Jeremy, Jason, James in North Carolina, Kyle in Alberta, Canada, Jennifer in Chicago, Dennis in Washington, Scott in Massachusetts, and James in Ohio. Wow, that's a lot of names. These are just the people who have actually joined me on or added me to their Facebook. So, and believe it or not, I actually left a few names out. Those are people who know me personally, and honestly, I don't even think they listen to my show. But thank you all for all the wonderful feedback you've given me over the last few years. All right, now it wouldn't be my show if I didn't have a break. I know I usually go from listener feedback directly to the first half, then a break, and finish with the second half, but I'm jumping directly into the break now. Why? because I want to play this interview in full and not cut it up. So here's a quick break, and right afterwards we'll start the interview with B. Alex from Esmeralda Distillery in northern Spain. Enjoy. After the first glass, you see things as you wish they were. After the second, you see things as they are not. Finally, you see things as they really are, and that is the most horrible thing in the world. Oscar Wilde, speaking about absinthe.
Okay, so today we're talking about absinthe, and I'm honored to introduce a guest on today's show, B. Alex, distiller from Esmeralda Distillery in northern Spain. I believe I got that right.
Hey, how's it going?
Thanks for joining us today.
Not a problem.
You make Upsello absinthe.
So correct.
How long have you been making absinthe?
Well, I've been making absinthe since about 99, mostly as a hobby. Right. And then in the last few years, I had a small little tiny micro distillery set behind Kenwood Winery in California. And that turned into a professional operation about going on 2 years now with Upsello.
Excellent. So I'm sure you're really excited about the whole absinthe hitting the market again in the U.S.
Yeah. I mean, it was a big surprise, actually. We set up the distillery before it became legal.
Mm-hmm.
So when we originally got into this, we were planning on doing a small little mom-and-pop operation, renting out a Catalan farmhouse in northern Spain, and sort of living in paradise, you know, shipping bottles through the internet, which was the classic mode of sales back then.
And that's how I got mine.
Yeah, I mean, that was the plan.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we got here and got done setting up the corporation and the basic structure, then they legalized absinthe in the United States, and, you know, we kind of looked at each other and went, oh, we need a bigger building.
Massive expansion.
Yeah, I mean, we ended up having to scrounge everything we could and put together a 6,000-foot distillery floor. So we've got a pretty good-sized operation now, but that was definitely a shock to the system.
Well, now that it's legal in the U.S., there's still a lot of people who haven't actually tried absinthe, and now they're like, oh, well, I've heard so much about it, you know, all the myths and everything that goes along with absinthe. So they're wanting to run out and grab it, you know, and they're just grabbing anything off the shelf. But they don't know really much about it. What exactly is absinthe, and how do you make it?
Well, okay, absinthe is a distilled spirit made from a combination of either wine alcohol or grain alcohol, redistilled with a pack of herbs. So it's made using the same process, more or less, that you would use to make gin.
Okay.
In the modern world, that's not always the case. So that's how you would correctly make an absinthe. So step one would be, in our case, we use a grape base. So we go to the Penedès region of Spain, and we get a hold of all the grapes from the growers there. And then we distill from that an eau de vie. Well, first we make wine, and then we distill an eau de vie from the wine, which is an unaged brandy.
Right.
And then that goes into the still with, in this case, in a 500-liter still with approximately 60 kilograms of herbs, or about 120 pounds of wormwood, anise, fennel, star anise, coriander, lemon balm, and those are the big ones.
Right.
And then that's then redistilled into absinthe, which comes out as a clear distilled spirit. And we then reheat that with a combination of other herbs that are used to extract the chlorophyll and color it green.
Excellent.
So that's how we make absinthe, and how you would make a traditional verd absinthe. In the modern world, unfortunately, you also have a host of other products that are essentially flavored vodkas that use food coloring to get the green color and use anise flavoring to make it taste something similar to absinthe.
Or even blue.
And then
you'll see something that they're trying to call absinthe and it's blue.
Yeah.
I don't think that's real.
I'm not naming names, but yeah, that one's probably the most classically not absinthe of the group.
Yeah. I think we know what that one is.
Yeah. But that's, I mean, in the modern world, it's a tricky business because you can't go off of price as a consumer. I mean, if you walk into the average store, you'll see everything on the shelf ranging from $45 or $40 up to $110.
Right.
And half of those products aren't actually absinthe, but they just bear the name and try to exploit it as a marketing opportunity.
Well, that's a great leeway to the next question I had for you was, you know, for people who are going out in the market, like you said, every day there seems to be a new absinthe on the mm-hmm. shelf.
And some great ones too.
But... Yeah. What should people look for when they're shopping for an authentic, high-quality absinthe?
Well, the first thing that people need to do, at least until the U.S. government gets their act together and puts a legal regulation in for what you can call absinthe, mm-hmm. in the meantime, I think doing your homework is probably the best way to find one. But there are some things you can use as a guideline. I mean, at this point, there are no clear absinthes on the market that are synthetic. So anything that's actually in a clear bottle and a translucent white absinthe is safe. And if you're looking for a vert or the traditional green, then you want to find something that's in a black bottle. It is 1Q, because the black bottle is used to prevent sunlight from causing the chlorophyll to change color. So if it's in a black bottle and it's a green absinthe, you're probably safe. There's one imposter on the market, but other than that one, everything in the black bottle is real. You also can use, if it's in a clear bottle, you would want to look for it to be brown. Because if you put real absinthe in a clear bottle, then the minute the chlorophyll comes into contact with sunlight, it's going to trigger the chlorophyll to turn into plant sugars, which downgrades the drink, but it'll turn it brown. So at least you know you're getting something real, even if it's perhaps slightly compromised. The brown is a little bit tricky. If it's turned brown from sunlight exposure, then in our world, we consider that an absinthe that's gone bad, if you will, because you're supposed to keep it out of the sunlight.
Right.
Now, on the flip side of that, though, if you take a naturally colored green absinthe and you put it in a cellar, in about 30 years, you'll have a golden-brown color that comes naturally without exposure to light. And that's actually, in our world, the most prized thing you can get your hands on.
Okay. Not naming names. No, I'm thinking of another absinthe that's nearby to me that is usually brown in a clear bottle. And, of course,
yeah,
it's aged for 30 years.
Yeah, I'm not naming names.
But... Yeah. So I'm just trying to get an idea. So it adds more of, when it's going brown, it adds a little bit more bitterness to it?
Well, it's not a bitterness. It causes if it gets exposed to sunlight and changes brown, what happens is the chlorophyll converts into a plant sugar. So it has an effect on the drink that's kind of like adding caramel coloring to a brandy mm-hmm. or to a whiskey. So you get a sweeter character, and it tends to flatten out a lot of the flavors. However, I will say that particular brand that you're discussing, which I'm not naming, I am a big fan of, if you can get your hands on it when it's fresh. When it's still green in the bottle, that's a really interesting answer.
Yes, I do kind of count myself lucky, the fact that I could just take the ferry across the bay. Well, I'm giving too much information now. well, I'm looking at your website, which I'll definitely want to make... I want to tell everyone out there that they have to go check out www.obsello.com. It's O-B-S-E-L-L-O. I'm looking at your information there, and I see that it states that the recipe has been refined for the modern palate. Can you explain what that means to you?
What that means is that I started with a traditional Spanish recipe,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't refine it in the sense that I reduced the wormwood content or refine it in the sense that I reduced the anise. I refined it really for my palate. So I just sat there playing with the balance and saying, okay, well, so here's a traditional Spanish absinthe.
You got a good palate, by the way. Go ahead.
Well, thank you much. but my project when I started this was, okay, so within the parameters of what is an absinthe, okay, the primary flavor's got to be anise. The wormwood has to be the dominant ingredient. So 60% of the mash has to be wormwood. And then within there, you can start to play with all kinds of different ingredients to accentuate one flavor or another. So just like when you're making, well, I make a gin as well. So just like making a gin, you choose certain herbs to accentuate parts of the flavor of the juniper berry. And with the absinthe, you choose certain parts to either add more of or reduce in order to get the concentration of the flavors that you want to accentuate. So in my case, that's a honey, vanilla, sort of nutty character that I happen to really like in an absinthe, and I chose my formula specifically to punch up those secondary notes.
Well, your description of the palette on the website, I don't think you could say it any better. People go and look at that, you know, it basically states characteristically sweet, minty flavors develop into a heavy finish. It is full-bodied yet refreshing. I think that's probably the best way to say it, because the first time I've actually tried Obsello, I noticed some of my other absinthes, I will do a four parts to one part absinthe, And with this one, I actually had to go down to about two parts water to one part absinthe. And I found that at first I thought, well, that's a really sweet, minty, very light flavor. And then the finish just comes on, and it's an unbelievable feeling. So it is definitely full bodied.
Thank you very much.
Now everyone out there
It's one of my life's
knows.
work, so.
Everyone else, people who are trying to think about trying absinthe, well, they all know about the myths. And unfortunately,
Which one?
well, the only way we're
There's
going to get rid of
two.
the myths is if we keep talking about them, unfortunately, because, I still get people going, I tried an absinthe and I didn't see pink elephants. So,
Yeah,
are they going to make me
doesn't do that.
hallucinate, or should I be really concerned? Should I not drink a lot of it? Is it poisonous? Could it kill me? What do you tell people who come up with those questions? Because I'm sure you get it.
Well, there's two parts. Okay, so the myth, just to summarize, what is the myth? There are really two myths. The first myth is that absinthe is hallucinogenic, which it's not. And the second myth is that absinthe will make you go crazy, which it also won't. And they have to be addressed independently of each other. And the reason why is that there is a compound in absinthe that's not present in other alcohols. And it does create a slightly different effect from drinking alcohol on its own. The madness part comes from something completely different. So let me tackle these one at a time. The hallucination myth actually comes from 100 years ago when they were making absinthe and it had rose to its ultimate peak of popularity. They were selling 36 million liters of this stuff a year in France. To put that in perspective, they were selling between 32 and 34 million liters of French wine. So they were moving as much of this stuff at that time as they were selling French wine. I mean, it's a huge volume. And with that, people that were coming from lesser socioeconomic backgrounds wanted to get their hands on absinthe because it was the fashionable drink. And just like today, profiteers came in and said, "Hey, we can make this stuff by taking grain alcohol and adding some food coloring and adding some flavoring essence and call it absinthe." Which is exactly what they did, except that they didn't have access to, say, food coloring like we do today.
Right.
And so they used copper sulfate as food coloring,
Ooh.
which is horribly toxic. And in the process of that, it caused hallucinations, delirium, and eventually madness, and sort of mimicked lead or heavy metal poisoning in the system. And we know that because we've done chemical analyses on historical bottles and found that the less expensive bottles from the 19th century often contain copper sulfate, which is really sad and did a lot to injure the history of our beverage. Now, on the flip side of that, the psychoactive aspect that people often talk about, absinthe does contain a compound called thujone, which comes from the wormwood plant. And it's a nervous system stimulant that causes your neurons to fire slightly faster in small doses. Now, they recently did a study on this in Germany, where they had a control group with alcohol alone, and then a group of people who were drinking alcohol with a small amount of thujone in it, comparable to what's in a modern glass of absinthe. And the overall effect was that people drinking 3 to 5 glasses of absinthe, or what would be comparable to absinthe, had an increased reaction time over the control group, as well as a sense of alertness or a feeling of well-being and clarity. So essentially, the difference between absinthe or a traditional alcoholic beverage is that it has a slight stimulating effect mentally. But it's very different than feeling intoxicated. It's more of a almost an anti-intoxicant. It's a very lucid sense of intoxication. Totally safe. The concentrations of that compound that would be dangerous are not present in absinthe. You'd die of alcohol poisoning long before you would ever feel a really pronounced effect from any of those compounds.
Yeah, I've always tried telling people that. I'm like, okay, here's a bottle of absinthe that's 50 proof or 50% alcohol by volume. To get as much thujone is to really screw you up. You better down more than a bottle, and I don't think you're going to get that far.
No. I mean, and not only that, but even historically, this was the same level of thujone 100 years ago as well. I mean, Berkeley recently did a study on 100-year-old bottles to measure the thujone concentrations and found that they averaged between 10 and 20 milligrams per bottle or per liter, which is right in line. I mean, the U.S. limit is 10 milligrams per liter now.
Right.
So absinthe never really had those kinds of concentrations in it either.
Fantastic.
I don't think it would be very pleasant.
No. All right, so I gotta know, what's your favorite way of drinking absinthe? You go by the drip, or do you have a favorite cocktail you like to mix it with?
I normally drink it with an absinthe drip. Mm-hmm. I've got a fountain in my house. I also periodically enjoy Death in the Afternoon cocktails, or recently I was turned on to the Sea Fizz. I was in New York visiting some clients of ours there, and they made me an amazing Sea Fizz. And that, I'm seriously a fan of that drink.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that one. I have to look that one up. Sea Fizz.
Yeah, that was amazing. I mean, it's a little difficult to make because I watched them, you know, separating egg yolks and all the other things that go into that. But that was really nice. I also like Manhattan cocktails with a splash of absinthe as well.
For me, a lot of people know it's the Sazerac.
Yeah. You know, I was in New Orleans last week, and I have to say, I had 3 or 4 Sazeracs I was not a huge fan of, and one that was absolutely amazing. And I'm trying to remember the name of the place that made me the really great Sazerac. Tommy's Wine Bar. Sorry, I got to plug them because that was a really great Sazerac.
Excellent. Yeah, definitely so, do.
I got to point that one out because that was just over the top great. And I think it was basically a traditional Sazerac, but they used a splash of cognac in it as well.
Very nice. So, you know, we've been speaking for a while about absinthe. Your distillery is Esmeralda Distilleries. I'm getting that right?
Yep, you got it.
You pretty much just make absinthe, or is there any other spirits that you make?
Well, we make absinthe commercially, and we're also about to launch a special edition absinthe, by the way, as soon as the U.S. government gets around to approving it. But in addition to that, we're also launching Port of Barcelona Gin, which you can take a look at the website, which is barcelonagin.com.
Okay.
And that is our newest contribution to the family. We make several others that are not publicly released yet because they're still in development phase. But Port of Barcelona Gin is on the market in New Orleans only at the moment. But next month you'll be able to pick that up in California, Las Vegas. It's already in New Orleans, also a couple of places in New York, and of course Northern Spain.
I look forward to seeing that come in. Now, of course, you're piquing my interest here. What's this special absinthe?
The special absinthe is, it is an interesting origin, actually. My assistant made a goof in one of the distillations and managed to produce a 1,500-liter batch of absinthe that had a flaw in it. And so I wouldn't let it go to market, but I kept it in a tank. And over time, I sat there thinking, well, what am I going to do with this stuff? And so I was making gin or working on researching the gin formula. And I started to take some of the different ingredients that I was using in the gin and added them to this goofed up absinthe and then redistilled it again. And in that process, I came across an absinthe that I thought was really great and totally unique. It was unlike any absinthe I'd ever had in the market before. And so I
think
I took a bottle.
Some of the best stuff happens from...
Completely by accident.
From goofs. Yeah, some of the best things on earth came from a goof. That's great. That's a good story.
The only problem with it is that none of us know how to recreate the goof.
Oh, yeah, that is a problem.
So there are actually 1,500 bottles of it that we're numbering all of them and signing all of them, and that's it. When those 1,500 are gone, then there won't be any more. And we're waiting for the U.S. government to approve that so that we can send it into the market. But that's going to be the next interesting one. And it's really unique absinthe. I think anybody who's, you know, I wouldn't say it's as general of an absinthe as Obseo is, in the sense that Obseo is quite traditional. But for somebody who's really accustomed to drinking absinthe and looking for something really unique, I think that the special edition might be a good fit.
Well, that sounds great. I can definitely start to, I can start to hear the music in the background, so I know that I don't want to hold you up too long because I know you have a carnival to get to.
Oh, no, you can hold me up as long as you need. The carnival is, it's actually 2 blocks from my apartment, so there are floats and parades and about 100,000 people in the street hurling beads and candy and all kinds of things.
I wish I was there. I love going to Europe. I love jumping the pond. I would live there if I could. Well, I thank you for taking the time to speak with us and talk about absinthe.
Sure.
And
thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Not a problem. Go out there and enjoy that that party. Have a glass of absinthe.
All right. Let's see if I can send you a couple photos.
Excellent.
Well, there you go. I want to send another big thank you out to B. Alex for taking the time to speak with me. He mentioned he was only told about this scheduled interview 20 minutes before the call began, and they were celebrating Carnival. This makes me very honored that he would talk to me on such short notice. If you're new to absinthe and you want to try a nice, smooth, traditional flavored absinthe, then I can definitely recommend Upsello. Pour an ounce of Upsello into a glass, place an absinthe spoon over the top with a sugar cube, and slowly drip ice water over the sugar. I'll be honest, I sometimes leave the sugar out. This absinthe has a wonderful, natural, sweet taste that I quite enjoy, and will just slowly add 2 to 2.5 ounces of ice water to it, and it's absolutely fantastic. He also mentioned he likes Death in the Afternoon, a Manhattan with a splash of absinthe, and the Sea Fizz. Here are how to make the Death in the Afternoon and the Sea Fizz. For the Death in the Afternoon, very simple. In a champagne flute, pour in 1 part absinthe to 4 to 5 parts champagne. To make the Sea Fizz, pour in a shaker, 1/2 ounce absinthe, 1/2 ounce lemon juice, a teaspoon of sugar, or better yet, simple super syrup, and 1 egg white. Shake first without ice to fully emulsify the egg white, then add ice and shake again to chill. Strain into a highball glass with ice and top off with soda water. That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed making it. Until next time, have questions or comments, feel free to email me at behindthebarshow@gmail.com, and it may make it on the next episode. Remember to check me out on Facebook and at my website, www.behindthebarshow.com, where I'll also be posting a link to Upsello. Cheers, everyone. Please drink responsibly. And remember, don't drink and drive.